Canadaland Commons is brought to you by our exclusive sponsor, Wealthsimple. If you are a listener of this podcast, you can get your first $10,000 managed for free for 2 years just by visiting wealthsimple.com/commons. Go check it out. Take a look. Even if you have $20 to put away, it's a start. So by now, we all know that Andrew Scheer won. He's the new Conservative Party leader. But last Saturday, all was yet to be revealed. And that's when we met some of you at the Monarch Tavern in Toronto. What you're about to hear is just how unexpected that victory was. You'll hear us talk with Ginny Movett, a senior consultant with Crestview Strategy, about this very weird race, the issues that were raised as about 100 Conservatives made a run for the crown, and finally, our flabbergasted surprise at the narrowly achieved upset, and whether or not this Andrew Scheer guy can unseat Justin Trudeau. Hadia couldn't make it. Many of you could. Ryan and I were in Toronto. From Canada Land, this is Commons.
The only rule tonight is that when you hear the phrase Canadian values, either from someone you're sitting next to, a pundit on the CPAC, or from one of the candidates themselves, everybody drinks. Do we agree?
Salut.
Let's raise a glass to that once. All right, here we go.
All right, so now let's get into the candidates who might do something tonight. In 10th place is Chris Alexander. Probably isn't going to end up being leader. I'm going to make that bold prediction right now. But he's a former Minister of Citizenship and Immigration. If you might remember him as the one who publicized that barbaric cultural practices hotline in the last election, stand-up guy. The interesting thing is that there are a lot of people in the establishment who will defend him and don't really understand where he ended up going with that cultural practices tip line. But he's also one of the people who was at that rebel media or rally where they started chanting lock her up. So any credibility he had as trying to be a consensus centrist candidate, I think, has long flown out the window.
Well, and he tried to follow me on Twitter as well, which was maybe a bad omen. I just politely asked him not to follow me. And he said, why not? And I said, I just don't want you to. And he went, okay. And then he unfollowed me.
That's amazing.
That was amazing. It was so civil. I was expecting a fight, but there was no fight there. He just politely unfollowed.
Chris Alexander could hang in for a bit, but a lot of his followers will probably go towards maybe Leach, maybe the Scheer is consensus, maybe even Lemieux, because he's really pushed his anti-M103 stance very loudly in his fundraising emails. Also one who was making friends with the rebel crowd. So then in 9th place at this point, we have Stephen Blaney. Again, he's one of those people where I sort of have that moment of, I guess I know who you are. You're in this race. You hung on. They all hung on for so long. Why? But he was a former Minister of Public Safety, a former Minister of Veterans Affairs, and part of the Conservatives' Quebec breakthrough, which might be why he thought he had a shot, because Quebec, the way that they have structured the vote tonight, regional representation has to be very broadly spread out. So anyone who can try and make inroads in Quebec, there's a reason O'Leary did drop out over his lack of support in Quebec. And in old school delegated conventions, when someone dropped out, you would see their group of people like move across the floor wearing their scarves and then go join this other team and don their colors. And it was this weird drama. And because it's a secret ballot, we can infer insight into where support went, but we won't know as definitively, which is interesting because it lacks that sort of kingmaker or queenmaker, maybe Kelly Leach will pull it out, drama of it all, where you end up having people being promised certain positions.
Well, and I really look forward to our conversation with Ginny in that way, because I think she'll bring a lot of perspective from the floor and give us a perspective on what might be happening right now during that vote. So we want to say thank you very much for being here, Ginny, as well. And we're going to run through the remaining. I mean, some of this is interesting, but we'll go through Blaney, Lisa Raitt, Kelly Leach, Pierre Lemieux. And now, if I had nightmares about anyone, it was Lemieux.
Yeah. He might actually be more offensive than Kelly Leach.
I believe so.
like actually, like on a lot of issues, but he flew under the radar. And I said this earlier, but he was third in fundraising.
Yeah.
And that to me says a lot. I got a lot of the candidates' email fundraising blasts, and his were particularly odious. They were, M103 is going to make it illegal to criticize Islam in Canada. C16 is going to make it so that your children are in bathrooms with men. If you don't know what C16 is, it's a bill to enshrine transgender rights in the Canadian, as a protected right under the Canadian Charter. Important piece of legislation that trans activists fought for a long time, that for a number of the candidates became something they were using to try and fundraise off of. And Lemire perhaps the most aggressively, although I will say Andrew Scheer, he's in second right now after the first ballot, has also been pretty vocal in his opposition to that.
That's right. Michael Chong sits in fifth place. Now, as a card-carrying NDPer, who voted for Trudeau in the last election. I'm here to be honest with you all. Michael Chong is the one that I thought I would eat dinner with that guy. He seemed pretty reasonable and also seems like he has no chance in winning. But that was my guy. I put $3 on him. And I'm going to lose $3.
Well, you know, he was the only one who supported a carbon tax. He voted for M103, the motion to condemn Islamophobia. He was the candidate who could have occupied that center space. And I think this is what's always interesting about leadership races, is you have to run to your base to win, and then you can move to the center. And he started in the center. But that fifth place to me shows that he at least managed to attract a lot of people who might occupy that center right space, who perhaps voted for Trudeau because they were tired of the Harper Conservatives, but could be courted as a conservative voter, especially given the deficits the Liberals are running and a lot of their broken promises already on things like electoral reform. There are soft center-right voters who perhaps Chong could have enticed. I don't think he's going to go from fifth to taking this, but I think that even though it's only, you know, 2,500 some odd points in the weird distributed point system, 7.5% of the total popular vote, that shows that he had a decent groundswell behind him. And you know who I'm not down with? Brad Tross, there we go. In fourth place, that's actually a lot higher than I would have put him on this if I'd written out my first ballot predictions. So that to me shows that he tapped. There is an appetite in the Conservative Party for the social conservative views to be aired and to be aired loudly. And he gave them that, or at least his campaign manager did in proxy by bizarre videos.
Aaron O'Toole, Andrew Scheer, and Maxime Bernier round out the top three. I think those were names that many people, had they been betting, would have expected in this space. And again, we know that 16,901
points.
Points.
So the points in each riding is worth 100 points.
Yes.
And then whatever percentage you got of that, you get that percentage of points. So what's really interesting right now is that Maxime is at 9,763.32 and Andrew Scheer is at 7,375.79. That is a much tighter margin than I expected on the first ballot.
Very tight.
So they have blown through a number of ballots while we were chatting.
Currently in first place, Maxime Bernier, 10,313 points, 30.51%.
All right, so we've got Ginny Movit up on the stage now. As I said, she is a senior consultant with Crestview Strategy and a former advisor to the Ontario Progressive Conservatives. So she is a veritable member of the Conservative Party of Canada who is there today voting. And will give us a sense. She's got her badge showing it off. Give us a sense of what was playing out on the floor.
It was a positive vibe. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why this could have gone really, really badly. I mean, the Liberals sent out an email yesterday saying that the Tories had out-fundraised them 2-1. And it was embarrassing, and they should probably donate. So that's a pretty good metric to go on as far as success is concerned. And this leadership will have the most votes of any leadership in Canadian history. So it was a really positive vibe for those very reasons.
So it seems like the narrative in this race was that the race was too long, there was too many candidates, there was a lot of negative spin around the race itself, and that the burden of 14 candidates and the distractions around some of the discourse in the race with some of the candidates was sort of a negative for the Conservative Party. Do you get that sense, or do you, like you just articulated, do you sense there is a good health with the party today?
It was kind of brutal to watch debates with 14 candidates, and like that was not fun for anyone. It was not compelling. It wasn't good TV. But I mean, it wasn't good TV. That's the point. I mean, I think a lot of this is coming from broadcast journalists who need to produce good TV, and you want conflict, you want drama, and there hasn't been a lot of conflict or drama, which has made it a little bit boring. Also, a lot of people who are critiquing this convention say they want to like hearken back to the days of someone crossing the convention floor in dramatic fashion, and I'm going to throw my support to so-and-so so I can be a cabinet minister in their government. That was that's not fair. Like, that's actually not that's a good not, way of choosing a leader.
That was the definition of old school backroom politics.
Right. So this is actually how you allow the grassroots to choose a leader in a pretty progressive way. Like, the great irony of the Liberal government having committed to made a commitment to electoral reform, and now the Tories are running their leadership on a ranked ballot. Like, interesting.
But they don't actually, they support a ranked ballot for their leadership, but they don't support it for a national election.
True. But I think, like, for the health of the party and the future, like, all those metrics you need to hit to be in a decent position to contest the next election, succeed as a party, like, I think objectively the Tories are in pretty decent shape. And that's not to say that there aren't challenges. No one knows any of these people's names in real life.
That's the problem.
Right? O'Leary they did, but the average Canadian does not know any of these candidates, well, and that is a serious problem when you're going to run against a celebrity.
When the new leader goes to work, what is the first thing you think the new leader of the Conservative Party needs to do on Monday morning?
So two things I think should be priorities. One is party unity. So while the party's been pretty united, like, let's not forget the history of this party. This is like a party in its infancy from a historical perspective. This is the second leadership we've had as a party. It is not, you cannot take for granted that the Conservatives will stay united as one party. And it's actually, shockingly, I think, successful and a testament to Stephen Harper that up until now we've been able to take that for granted to a certain extent. But there are superficial fissures become deep-seated fissures, that's a big problem. So I think unity is task number one, and it's reaching out to every other leadership campaign and all their teams and saying, rah, 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 we're one big team, let's do this. And then it's name recognition. So I think that's, the House will rise soon. And then it's like hot dog eating barbecue circuit all summer. And, you know, you pick a couple, like, policy areas early on to define yourself so people can, so you get coverage and people know who you are. But don't go down the policy path too early, because that's a recipe for disaster.
The top three are what people were expecting at this point. But are you surprised with where Michael Chong is right now?
So I think Michael Chong ran a really good campaign as far as defining his issues. And I think I didn't think this would happen, but it looks like what he successfully did was say, if you are a card-carrying conservative who feels a certain way about climate change and a certain way about a certain social issues, and you're a red Tory, you're a little left within the party, I am your person. And I'm not going to hedge on that, and I'm not going to be unclear about it, and I'm not going to sometimes tell you that I'm a social, you know, liberal, but then change my mind on other days. He was really consistent, and I think he successfully took all of those red Tories within the party, or a lot of them, and coalesced them under his name, which I think is why Ray did relatively poorly, and O'Toole isn't really rising to expectations. So Ontario is a bedrock of red Toryism, much to my chagrin, and I think that has really, really benefited Chong, and he ran an objectively a really strong campaign.
Did Rate want it? I've heard a lot of gossip that she was running for Atlantic Canada and for female representation, not for the leadership.
I think she did. I think she would love to be leader. I think she got in too late. I think if Lisa were to be able to mount the right kind of campaign to be successful, she would have needed to have started a long time ago. And she would have needed to have started learning French a long time ago. So the timing was not right for Lisa. And I think she knew that. And she's done a really nice thing in the last week, which is she hasn't pretended she's going to win. She said, I care more about the party than that. I want to talk about unity. I want to talk about everyone, you know, messages we need to have as a party, because she knew she wasn't going to win.
So Kelly Leach is on the screen behind us right now, and I see people visibly, like, grimacing in our crowd. So, like, that... I don't think necessarily a lot of people in this room are her base, but what happened to her campaign? She went from being a presumed front runner to barely registering in the top set of ballots here.
If you're going to define yourself by one issue, which is a wedge issue in the sense that people either fall on one or the other side and they feel pretty strongly about it, you're going to motivate your voters, but you have to be aware that your voters might be few and far between. And I think, you know, you see these polls that say that 60% of Canadians actually do want to pay closer attention to who we allow into the country, because I don't, actually, when you phrase it that way, it doesn't sound all that unreasonable, and frankly we already do that anyway.
Yeah.
But it's not their most important issue. It's not the thing they care about the most. So the only people who voted for her are people who cared about that the most. And they weren't all that motivated. But like, what I think is so interesting is how well Lemieux and Trost did. And people tend to, particularly from the left, I think, lump together all of the types of conservatives that they find abhorrent. And so, you know, when people talk about it clumsily, they talk about, oh, those crappy conservatives that I hate, like Lemieux and Trost and Leach, and they're all like Trump. And well, no, they're actually very, very different. She was racist. But social conservatives are often people of another race. Like,
yeah.
Recent immigrants are often the most ardent social
and
conservatives.
And that's the coalition that Jason Kenney and Stephen Harper tapped into so well,
right,
to build that majority, where the social conservatives, many of whom were newer Canadians, either first or second generation,
yep,
and that Leach completely alienated. So do you think that community has stayed with the party, or do you,
yes,
think...
I think they played an important role in this leadership campaign. And I think that's a good thing for the party. And I think that it's a warning sign to anyone that wants to succeed in politics anywhere in Canada that you cannot alienate immigrant communities. And nor should you. I mean, also, it helps that it's unethical and wrong, but...
Tell us what you really think, Jenny. <Yeah. laughs> So, a lot of people have said that Leach dropped in the polls immediately after Kouvalis exited the campaign, saying, you know, he's this wonder boy who could have won it for her. Or was it a reaction to the damage that he did?
I think that's a little convenient and places campaign operatives on a pedestal that maybe that is not fair. And it goes in the same direction where, like, losers are always losers and winners are always winners. And it's rarely because of, there's so many factors beyond strategic decisions made by senior campaign staff that affect elections. So, I disagree. The great irony of Kelly Leach, I mean, I think we should paint her with a racist brush because she chose to sign on to this campaign. And we shouldn't be shy about that. But that's actually not who she is. Like, she's so inauthentic. And this is what the party rejected, I think. People who actually knew Kelly, who's been involved since she was, like, 14 years old. She's, like, a weird red Tory who doesn't really believe that much. And someone did a focus group that a couple racists happened to sneak into and said, this is what you have to run on. And she, like, on a weird automaton, just, like, subsumed two or three talking points and just repeated them over and over and over again. And it was, like, anyone who knows her knows that it's, like, the most inauthentic, opportunistic, weird thing. And I think that also turned off a lot of people.
But how does that happen? I mean, how does... someone as smart as, because I've heard this about Kelly Leach, I've on this podcast have made fun and joked about, I told a personal story of seeing her in an Air Canada lounge in Edmonton be very rude to a server when her Shirley Temple wasn't mixed properly. I've given her a lot of shit, but I've heard over and over again how smart she actually is and how this isn't a fair representation. So how does this happen publicly? Who does she have around her?
Having a high IQ doesn't make you a good person.
Good and, night. That and, is show enough. Right?
And like, look, she's an orthopedic surgeon. You don't become an orthopedic surgeon, okay, by being a dummy. So,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But she's also, what people consistently say about her, even people who really like her, is that she has been really, really cold-bloodedly ambitious from day one. She's a really successful person. She's checked a lot of things off her list, which is why she has so many letters after her name and insists that they be...
Do you know how many, for the record?
There was a button, actually, at the convention, which I'll show you after, that has, like, 54 letters after
her. Oh, my God. That's two alphabets.
I think she genuinely convinced herself that this was a reasonable policy, and when you talk about it in terms of, should we ask people questions when they come to our country to make sure they don't want to do bad things, no one objects to that. But
we already do it.
Right. Right. So it was where Michael Chong was profoundly intellectually honest in his approach to running in this campaign, Kelly was so intellectually dishonest that the inauthenticity was just so palpable that people just didn't have time for it.
Because the debates, I tried to watch the debates, they were just a train wreck, and I didn't get a sense of what the actual campaigns were like. Can you share a little bit what you know about what the actual campaigns on the ground were like for some of our leading candidates and what those conversations may have been with voters and with these leadership?
Sure. So I'll start with Bernier, who is currently the front runner and has been since almost day one. His greatest strength was that he got in early, very early. And he was really, really serious. He didn't hum and haw. He said, like, I'm running. I'm going to get really solid operatives, and I'm going to commit time and money and effort and get out there. And they ran an objectively strong campaign. So they had a really, really strong ground game, which means you have regional organizers in every province and then organizers beneath them and people, you know, very, very organized. And that has been consistent throughout. And then he said, I'm going to have like 6 or 8 policy pillars that will define me early on so people know what they're voting for. Mm. So that's Bernier, and he's been very successful for that very reason. He also wears a suit very, very well.
Oh, Maxime.
He does have a certain charm.
He's really hard not. He's also just really likable. I mean, he's a bit of a lone wolf in caucus, so he kind of doesn't. I think a lot. He didn't have a lot of caucus support because he's not one of these guys who says, like, I need to build consensus. He just says, no, this is how I feel. Like, this is, we should dismantle the CBC because I don't like it.
And he has that French accent in a way that's like the good one too, like the suave one.
Let's focus this conversation. Jesus Christ. You know, he has nice hair as well, like Trudeau.
Well, and that matters, though. Wait, let's talk about how that matters.
All right.
Because if we have, let's say we have Justin Trudeau running against a Maxime Bernier or an Andrew Scheer who has that sort of boy next door,
and
you want to make him bad sort of vibe.
And
Jagmeet Singh for the NDP.
All in nice suits. Three men.
Of course, they're all men, but let's move on from that.
Oh, this is the
2024, 2023, ladies. We'll get there. But it matters to have someone photogenic going up against this photobomb selfie prime minister. I think it really does.
Yeah, like I agree with you, but I also think I would prefer someone who can who is telegenetic, but who can draw some helpful points of contrast. So some of the blush has worn off the Trudeau rose. I don't want to overstate that because he's still pulling very well. But some, you know, people have, there was this moment when he came back from Christmas vacation and we heard about his, how he got to his vacation. And then they were being stupid in the House of Commons. And there was this sort of moment of, and he'd broken some promise and maybe he's not what we thought he was, like, you think? Anyway. So that will continue to happen. So who can take advantage of that? And I think it's going after where he's weak. So he's elite. He's entitled. He's been a celebrity essentially since he was born. Not by his own choosing, but that's a reality.
He crashes proms in Vancouver.
Yeah, but not because that was actually a photo op. And,
obviously,
right? So he's inauthentic. Right. He's narcissistic. Like that. I think that's the stuff that's starting to stick a little bit. So who can draw some contrast? Instead of trying to fight him on his own terms, you know. And this is a good segue to Andrew Scheer. I think Scheer's point was, he's urban. I'm suburban. Mm. He's like a selfie guy. I just hang out in the backyard with my own kids. Like, you know, and I think that would be that's the helpful contrast that I think that's reasonable. And I think that worked for Scheer. And that's been his play from day one. And it's, you know, Stephen Harper won a majority. So there are lots of things he did right. And I want to do a lot of those things too. But at the end of the day, he was just an old guy with gray hair and he wasn't really good at smiling. And I can smile and I'm younger.
You brought up Harper. What, from a minority to a majority to Trudeau, what was the state of the Conservative Party post Harper going into this leadership campaign? What was happening inside of the party as this campaign started? And sort of take us through where the party was to where it is now today.
Sure. So after Election Day 2015, the party was not in a good place. We probably should have done better than we did, which isn't to say we did all that badly. Justin Trudeau won a majority. Like the seats played out that way because the NDP tanked, right? So the Tories did badly. They lost seats. The NDP did really badly, and the Liberals won a majority. And the Liberals ran a really, really good campaign. But the Tories won 30%, I think, of the popular vote. Like that's pretty good. So they don't need that much more to win government. So once that kind of set in, it was like, okay, let's reset. Let's refresh on staff. Let's, you know, clear out the... And then you move into an interim leadership election. I think Rana was the perfect choice for interim leader. And that's not because... That's not to say I think Rana should have run for leader. I think Rana is best in the role she was in. She did an amazing job. She also had a really strong team, and they said, we're going to refocus on things like social media that maybe we didn't care about all that much before. And we're gonna get out there and just have really good photo ops and, you know, look really good and not take relatively inoffensive positions on things that aren't going to piss people off when we don't need to. And now we're in a position where everyone feels all of a sudden really good, like with this data. And I think it's because of the data. You can't argue with the membership numbers. You can't argue with the fundraising numbers. And a lot of that is attributable to Rana. But a lot of it is also attributable to, say what you will about 14 candidates. And yes, it was annoying and it made for really brutal debates. But it showed that a lot of people want this job.
So we have the eighth ballot, speaking of who wants the job, coming down right now. So these are some results. It looks like this is the ballot that may bump Kelly Leach off.
Rounds 8, 9, 10 will be announced. People will be eliminated from 8, 9, and 10.
Which candidates are being eliminated on the 8th round. 9th round, and then we will announce the results of the 10th round. No candidate has yet achieved 50%.
On the 9th ballot, in 6th place, Kelly Leach.
Thank you, Kelly. In 5th place, en 5e place, le candidat Michael Chong. 3,090 votes.
3,090.04 votes.
In 4th place, Brad Trost. 4,633, 13.71%.
En 3e place, in 3rd place, candidat Aaron O'Toole, 4,947.14.64% du vote.
In 2nd place, Andrew Scheer, 9,557.28.28%.
En première place, Maxime Bernier, 11,570.
Maxime Bernier, 11,570.34.23%.
Let's raise a glass for our friend Kelly. I don't know.
It was fun while it lasted.
My glass is empty. Can I have a glass?
Me too, please.
Interesting.
There's a tab.
Where do Kelly Leach's numbers go? Where do those ballots go?
I don't know. I mean, Bernier made a serious effort later in the game to try to say, like, I would crack down on refugees coming up from the U.S. and to try to take control of that, you know, percentage of people who want to make sure that there are tough laws around immigration. So maybe that endears some Leach people to him. I also think that there's a bit of a rural interest in Leach. And I think that some of that might benefit Scheer.
Right.
I'm very curious to see where those next ballots go. And where there's potentially good news for Scheer is, so Trost is shockingly high on the ballot. I'm not surprised the Social Conservatives did well, because I think people just don't understand how, for whom there are so many members of this party for whom those things are important. And I like to talk about cultural conservatism, because when you talk about libertarians, red Tories, and social conservatives, you don't actually capture people who say, matters of life and whether I'm pro-life or not is fine. I'm for gay marriage, but I'm not actually defined by my fiscal conservatism or my red Toryism. I care about things like whether parents get to decide what their kids do instead of the government and their schools, or like those kinds of sort of intangible cultural conservatism things.
And it's really hard to pull that in like a yes or no.
It's really hard to pull that. And I think that's why we're seeing that. I think there are a lot of people that feel that way, not only in the party, but in the country. And that's where we're seeing some of these votes land with Trost.
And Bernier is a very clear libertarian, but he, you know, he's not married. He's had a series of live-in girlfriends. These are the kinds of things that
loosely connected at one point to the Hell's Angels.
These things don't play well in parts of the conservative base. And the momentum right now, where we're seeing the votes going, is sheer. He's grown more since the earlier ballots at this point than Bernier. And Scheer did build a lot of goodwill as Speaker.
Yeah.
There was, you know, within, especially, you know, most of caucus endorsed O'Toole. He had the most caucus endorsements, right? But Scheer would have
this second most by a very close margin.
Yeah.
And he's really the only strong Western Canadian prairie candidate on the ballot. So, you know, Bernier is a Quebec guy. O'Toole is a Ontario guy. And so is Chong. So if you were just a Western-centric person, if you're the kind of person who joined the Reform Party because you felt like the West needed back in, as it were, and you still feel that way, for whatever reason, whether it has to do with a carbon tax or anything like that, you might say that Scheer is the only one left who could make sense to you.
That's a very happy-looking Andrew Scheer on the screen behind us.
Absolutely. And he's kind of flown under the radar. Like, Bernier was so... And their campaign was really good at looking like they had momentum. So when I was there just a few hours ago, his entrance onto the convention floor was, like, you know, cheers of Max, 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 and, like, a big, big deal. Lots of young people around him. It was the same way at the Manning Center Conference, which is the big sort of ideological conservative conference that happens in the winter. Constantly surrounded by a gaggle of young men, you know, with Ayn Rand books in their hands or whatever. And Scheer was just a little subtler than that, so this might catch some people by surprise, although it's not all that surprising to me.
This is Hadia Rodrigue. I hope you're enjoying this special live episode of Commons as we digest the conservative leadership race. This live taping of Commons is brought to you by our exclusive sponsor, Wealthsimple, the easy way to manage your investments. Commons listeners can get up to $10,000 managed for 2 years for free by visiting www.wealthsimple.com/commons. And as I can personally attest to, Wealthsimple makes investing easy for anyone from a PhD student and freelancer to a 70-year-old dad looking to build his dream retirement home made of bamboo in his home country. You can choose to invest in socially responsible investments, doing good for our planet and society while doing good things for your pocketbook. Or you can just go for the money if you don't want to be socially responsible. If you're a recent grad sitting on a sweet tax refund because of your tuition credits, or a steady saver, Wealthsimple can and will work for you. Skip buying those $500 Jordans and do the right thing for your future. Again, our exclusive sponsor is Wealthsimple, and you can get $10,000 managed for 2 years for free, no management fees, at www.wealthsimple.com/commons.
The Conservatives are sitting at almost 260,000 members right now. When Trudeau was elected to leadership of the Liberal Party, they were sitting at 60,000. And that's with that, hey, sign a fancy-pantsy little pledge and you can vote for us. So that actually is pretty telling about where that vote base is. And I think too often in our urban bubbles, we forget where this country actually sits on the political spectrum.
Absolutely. This is like the John Ibbotson thesis, right? Which I think there have been a lot of holes poked in that thesis over the last few years for good reason. But there is something, and the country is becoming more urban, and the Conservatives need to confront that or they'll be doomed. But there is something to the idea that we, the commentariat class, are in our urban bubbles, and we think that people don't join political parties and that, you know, how could anyone ever buy a Conservative membership and vote for them? Well, 260,000 160,000 people in your country did, and where the liberal vote is a lot more volatile, and they can do a lot better, and they can also do a lot worse. About 30% of the people in the country vote conservative. And, you know, you can't take that for granted because that could change. But that has been pretty consistent. And there's almost a floor. There's been a floor to the conservative vote. And again, that's not enough. You cannot win with that. But it's a really nice base to have. This is why people talk about the base. And this is why you can't disrespect the base or take them for granted, because they matter.
I think the interesting question is, where do Truss supporters go? And they would go to Scheer before Bernier, right, Ginny?
Yes. A bad, misbehaving SoCon is the worst kind of SoCon for SoCons. And there was a bit of a message that emerged from both Lemieux and Truss near the end of the campaign that Scheer professes to be a social conservative. He is supposedly Catholic, but he is a traitor among our people because he has said that he wouldn't allow the abortion debate and other debates to be reopened in the House of Commons because he doesn't want to lose the election. The general election. So they have said you should punish him, you shouldn't support him, even though you might think as a social conservative he should be your second or third choice. Whether or not that sticks, I don't know. If you're an average social conservative voter in rural Western Canada, you might just say, I don't care what you have to say, Brad Trost, I'll vote for you first because you'll defend my right, you know, you'll defend babies, unborn babies the most. But I think Andrew Scheer will defend unborn babies the second most, so I'm going to vote for him. So I don't know how that's going to look. I don't know whether people are going to follow that advice or not. Look, O'Toole and Scheer were fighting over being the quote-unquote consensus candidate, meaning Bernier's in the lead. If you don't think Bernier makes sense for whatever reason, you should vote for one of us. Scheer was obviously more successful in doing that. The people that want to continue that Harper-era message will go to Scheer, and the people who want something different will go to Bernier. When you look at this group of candidates and you look at some of the shining stars in caucus and some of the new people that were elected last time around, I don't feel at all uncomfortable about what a potential conservative front bench would look like, and I don't think the party does either.
So the leader of this party in 2019, because of the way Trudeau and the Liberals are polling quite strong, has their work cut out for them. What will 2019 bring for the Conservative Party as we go into that election? What are you kind of seeing or anticipating in that way?
So campaigns are defined by the issues of the day, and it's hard to predict now what they'll look like. And it will in large part be determined by whether it's Bernier or Scheer. Look, Donald Trump is still going to be looming very large, unless he's, like, I don't know, impeached or something by then. And these are the kinds of things that the candidates weren't talking about this during the leadership campaign because there wasn't much to say. But that's going to be how a new leader would deal with Trump in contrast to, you know, Trudeau is going to talk to over the phone and meet with Trump a number of times, but again, between now and 2019. And how that plays out will be massive. There'll probably be a few more terrorist attacks between now and then, unfortunately. There are all sorts of issues that you don't plan for. And that's why I think a big reason, the big thing that impacts why you choose a leader is not necessarily what they stand for today, but what kind of a person they are and what their leadership style is and how they'll respond to the issues of the day.
Mm. Part of my interest in the Canadian political landscape is I'm an Indigenous person. I'm a status Indian. And I wonder what the Conservatives see in terms of the reconciliation movement and the political and social call for a better Canada that way. Are you able to speak to that in terms of sort of a
I mean, I can speak for myself and conversations I have with my colleagues and in the party. I think there is a broad-based recognition that we can no longer not have a position on Indigenous issues. I hope that's the understanding, and I think that will be, I hope and think that will be the belief of the new leader. It's also helped, look, these issues are very, very challenging, and I think there was a bit of hubris on the part of the Liberals in saying, we will fix the clean water crisis. We will fix the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue. And now you're seeing, well, actually, it's really, really, really hard, and it takes a long time. And it's great to go up there. Absolutely, Justin Trudeau should go to Shoal Lake and should do this, you know, have his face seen and confront these issues. But when it comes to delivering, he's far from being there. And you're hearing that a bit from the community. Actually, Jody Wilson-Raybould's father, who's a leader in the community in BC, came out and said, this reconciliation so far has been of a bit of a sham. It hasn't happened. It's been slow. So there's an opportunity, I think, for the Tories to say, let's actually take a couple of years to think about how we can use our ideology and the values we share to confront what is a massive, massive issue for Canadians in a way that what would contrast with the Liberals, who I think have dropped the ball.
I think the friction between Indian Country and the Conservative base is very real, especially in the provinces where the Conservatives poll the highest. These are traditionally places where we see the most conflict, and you know these questions won't go away. And in fact, you know, the Indigenous population is the fastest growing in Canada. 40% of the Indigenous population in Canada is under the age of 25. These will be voters.
Yep.
And these will be people that, frankly, many of them, myself included, I voted for the first time federally.
Yep.
Last election, I helped put Trudeau there.
Yeah, the Liberals did really, really well on reserve. They did really, really well among Indigenous people in the last election. The data bears that out.
So it's one of those, I think it's one of those that the Conservative Party would be, well-to-do should they put some attention there, because, you know, frankly, the issues don't go away. Some of the issues will get worse by 2019. Some will get markedly better. I think, you know, it's one of those political discussions that it is an issue that creates tension, creates awkwardness.
I agree, but when you come down to it, Scott Gilmore did a good job of this, I think, in the Maclean's, where he basically just said there is fundamental data that we can't ignore. Death rates, addiction rates. You know, we have a community within our country whose outcomes are grossly and disturbingly out of sync with the rest of the country. And that is just a fact that can't be ignored. And you're right to say that the more Indigenous people that vote, unfortunately, this is true, the more Indigenous people that vote, the more their issues will matter, because they'll be able to have more of an impact on elections. And I hope Indigenous people continue to do that. But I also think there's an opportunity to say, Justin Trudeau has been disappointing and hasn't lived up to his promises. So how would we go about trying to do those same things, the same things differently?
I would have voted for Michael Chong. I'm telling you this right now. I fell in love with a lot of what Michael Chong stood for and talked about. And it's interesting times in Canada, indeed. Ashley?
As we wait for the 13th and final ballot to determine who, likely between Andrew Scheer and Maxime Bernier, will be the next leader of the Conservative Party of Canada and the leader of the official opposition in the House of Commons, let's talk a little bit about each of their platforms. So actually, just right now, I was trying to pull up Scheer's platform again. I was reading it earlier today again to refresh myself, and his team has completely scrubbed his campaign website, and now it just says, thank you. But I had some short form notes, and we also had Maxime Bernier. So the interesting thing about both of these candidates is Bernier very staunchly ideologically libertarian, Andrew Scheer a little bit more centrist but with some social conservative leanings. That's always sort of been his brand or his bag. But they had a lot of cross-section, like both want to, you know, improve gun rights, want to reduce the size of government. Those sort of conservative...
they agree on the bread and butter, easy, inoffensive policies.
Yeah, yes. And they both voted against Motion M103, and they both fundraised off of opposition to that. They both brought up C-16, the new transgender rights bill, in their fundraising and in their campaign. So the Liberal Party of Canada is already lining up how they're going to react to the new leader, especially if it is Andrew Scheer. Gerald Butts, who's the principal secretary to the Prime Minister, one of the architects of his campaign, is already tweeting that the Canadian anti-choice movement is on the verge of selecting the new Conservative Party leader. Scheer and the life issue is certainly going to be something the Liberals are going to try to use to brand him. If you were working for him, how do you, you know, day one, start trying to push back against that?
Well, I think Scheer's team already was very smart in saying, look, our guy could win, So from day one, we need to be very clear that while his views might be pro-life, he would never allow the debate to be reopened in the House of Commons. And
which was the Stephen Harper and, with a smile
stance. I mean,
stance.
No one believed it. It was always about a secret agenda. It was always about a hidden agenda. And it never happened because he didn't want to lose. And he knew he'd lose if he did that. So I believe Scheer will take a very, very similar approach. And I think Jerry Butts knows that full well. But I don't blame him for going after the party for that reason, because I would do it if I were him.
Well, it's good politics,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I don't blame him.
And the next leader of the Conservative Party of Canada with 51% of the vote.
The next leader, Andrew Scheer.
And we have Ginny Bowman here cheering. So I guess if she let her poker face down who she was rooting for in the showdown between Maxime Bernier and Andrew Scheer. Why are you happy that Andrew Scheer is leading your party?
Andrew Scheer, I think, has the best personality for the job. I think he has the best leadership style for the job. I think he has the best judgment for the job. And he best represents the coalition of conservatives that it takes to win government. And I'm really excited for him. I think this is great news for the party. He's super young. He's got a ton of kids. And he's super energetic. And this process could have gone badly in so many ways. There could have been technical issues with voting. There could have been sniping back and forth. And, like, I'm less happy about the fact that Scheer won and more happy about the TV shot I just saw 10 minutes ago of Scheer, O'Toole, and Bernier standing side by side, because their willingness to do that with, I think, a genuine smile on their face says a lot about how united the party is.
Give us your thoughts on the success of Scheer's campaign. What was it that you think conservative voters saw in Andrew Scheer that perhaps they didn't see in Bernier directly?
I think Scheer said, I don't need to stake out aggressive and firm policy ground and policy ground that's going to alienate me from the average voter. I just need to tell people what kind of guy I am. And I think people liked what kind of guy he was. Whether that will be true within the general population, I don't know. That remains to be seen. And there are a lot of people who don't know who he is. This is his biggest challenge. He now needs to go out there and kiss babies and shake hands. But I think that's why he was successful. And his campaign realized that it was little nuggets of policy that said, I'm the kind of guy you want in your corner. These are the kinds of things I care about. And I think that worked really well for him.
Ginny, we want to say thank you so much for being here. How about a big round of applause for our friend Ginny for coming in this evening to spend the evening with us. We really appreciate you.
It was a great time. Whenever I could drink and speak to people recording at the same time is a good day.
That's our show for this week. I'm Ashley Chinati. You can follow me on Twitter at Ashley Chinati. That's Ashley with an L-E-Y. My last name's a little weird. C-S-A-N-A-D-Y.
And I'm Ryan McMahon. Follow me on Twitter at RM Comedy.
Check out our website at canadalandshow.com/commons. And you can email us at commons@canadalandshow.com. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/canadaland.
The producer of Commons is Russell Gregg, and our music is produced by Nathan Burley.
Thanks again to Commons' exclusive sponsor, Wealthsimple. Get your first $10,000 managed for free for 2 years at wealthsimple.com/commons. If you like what we do, please support us.
This episode of Commons is brought to you in part by Canardian. What is Canardian, you ask? Well, it is a podcast that's gossiping about Canadian hometowns. Every episode, podcast producer and writer Katie Lauer is joined by various Canadian podcasting personalities to unravel the juicy stories about their hometowns from trusted sources like eyewitness testimony, community Facebook groups, subreddits, and Wikipedia. Nothing I say is fact-checked, but it is pretty dang entertaining. And you know who is a guest on this season of Canardian? Well, none other than yours truly. So if you are interested in the very important distinctions between Surrey and North Delta, if you want to learn whether or not I could outrun the Delta PD, well, this is the podcast for you. Listen and subscribe to Canardian from Pod the North right now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. This episode is brought to you in part by the Douglas Mattress. Now, I've said it before and I'll say it again. One of the best, and I mean the best, things you can do for yourself is to get a good quality mattress. The time is now, people. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress protector, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.